I would describe us here in the US as being the tallest midget in the group. And that's sort of where I am about the world. And we need a rocking change in the thing, a change in direction in all of these five kingdoms. And we need it soon to get reestablished growth and prosperity in the world economy. Much the way Reagan did it, much the way Kennedy did it. All Kennedy was very short-lived, but Reagan started it. It was Thatcher followed on, the rest of the world followed on, and we have been in this slow period. And I'm very concerned about the long-term health of the world economy and the U.S. economy.
Welcome to Thoughtful Money. I'm its founder and your host, Adam Taggart. If we care about the future of the economy, then we have to pay close attention to the policies that shape it. We're currently living in an age of extreme and, in certain cases, unprecedented levels of monetary and fiscal policy. Is that wise? Or should market forces be allowed to play out more and free us from the constant intervention of the central planners? To explore this, we welcome economist Dr. Arthur Laffer. Dr. Laffer was the first to hold the title of chief economist at the Office for Management and Budget in the early 1970s. He then later served as a member of President Reagan's Economic Policy Advisory Board. He's perhaps, though, best known for developing the Laffer Curve, a model for determining the optimal balance between tax revenues and economic growth. Dr. Laffer, thank you so much for joining us today, right after coming back from a trip to Europe.
Thank you very much. It's a real pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I think this is your, we talked at my prior company. I think this is your first appearance here on the new Thoughtful Money channel. Thank you so much. A lot of people have been asking for you to come on.
Hi.
So we're going to make them happy. Yep. Got a lot of fans. I got a lot of questions here for you, Dr. Laffer. We got a limited amount of time, so I'm going to do my best to crunch on through them.
Great.
If we can kick it off with the general question I like to start these conversations with, what's your current assessment of the global economy and financial markets?
The way I'd like to assess the global economy and financial markets right now is not to look at it in terms of smooth landing or takeoff or whatever those things are. I'd like to look at it at a lot broader perspective, let's say from the year 2000 to the present, if I could. And we're going through a period here in the world economy of senescence, of decline, ever since Bill Clinton, and Bill Clinton's administration was an exceptionally effective administration. I supported Bill Clinton. I voted for him twice. I thought he was a great president. And since then, we've been moving in the wrong direction. Now, if I can, on that, describe the direction and how I look at the world. I look at the world from the standpoint of the five kingdoms of macroeconomics. And let me just outline them for quickly, if I could.
Please.
Number one, taxation. Obviously, that's one I love, 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 and I focus on it. Number two, government spending. Number three, monetary policy and inflation. Number four, regulatory policy, incomes policies, that type of thing. And number five is international trade. That's sort of the way I get my arms around the trunk of the tree, if you will. And I look at the world. And if you look at that from the, let's say, from the post-Clinton era, it has been moving badly in the wrong direction, and not just here. I'm going to go through it here with you in some detail, but I'll go at it in the rest of the world as well, because it's really a global phenomenon, not just a U.S. one. Taxes. The ideal tax system is a low-rate, broad-based, flat tax. You know, so you provide people with the least incentive to evade, avoid, or otherwise not report taxable income, and you give them the least number of places to stick their income. If you look at spending policy, we all know we need government, and we need it, and we need a lot of government. Who's going to do the roads, the defense, the judiciary, all of the schools? There is a huge role to be played by government. And if government does not play a sufficient role in the economy will underperform. But then again, government can be pushed way too far. And when it goes beyond the bounds of where it's really effective, it also destroys the economy. There's an optimal level of government. And I'm going to put it today that we've gone way beyond the effective bounds of government. And we are in a period here where we need to restrain government spending. We need spending restraint is what we actually need. That's the North Star. Monetary policy. What you want from monetary policy is you want a stable numerary, sound money. so that you and I and all of us can know what the value of a dollar is 5 years from now, 10 years from now, 20 years from now, so that we can make long-term contracts, whether it be in labor or investments or bonds or whatever. You need price and monetary stability. And again, we've gone way outside of that range. We have much higher inflation, much worse balance sheet of the Fed, et cetera. Fourth policy is regulation. We all know we need regulations, and we know we need them very much. You can't choose one day to drive on the left-hand side of the road and then say, hey, I changed my mind and drive on the right-hand side the next day. We need them, but we want to make sure that regulations don't go beyond the specific purposes at hand and create a lot of collateral damage. We don't need that. And my view is with energy regulations, with a lot of these other regulations, we've gone way beyond the pale and are way over-regulating the economy, my view. Lastly is international trade. International trade is as important as any topic I can think of. We make some things better than foreigners, and they make some things better than we do. We and they would be foolish in the extreme if we didn't sell them those things we make more efficiently than they do, and they sell us those things they make more efficiently than we do. It's called the gains from trade, comparative advantage, David Ricardo there. When I look at the world, we are moving in all five of the grand kingdoms of macroeconomics, taxes, spending, monetary policy, regulation, and trade. We are moving in the wrong direction, and that has led to a decline in growth in the entire world. What I like to call a senescence for the last quarter century. You can look at it in terms of participation rates here in the U.S. or real GDP growth or what have you. If you go to Britain, where I just was, it's gotten so bad in Britain that they're now calling the pound the ounce. It's a disaster. The EU is clotting. It's sclerotic. It's not doing well at all. Russia, there used to be a country called Russia. Russia is literally just disappearing from the world economy. Xi is moving in the wrong direction on economic policies. The miracle that was China now is being reversed. Even Chile in South America, which was the highest performing country in South America, has flipped switches and is now in a steep dive. And lastly, Japan. You know, in 1989, I think it was, that Japan's market cap was the same as the U.S. It's not anymore. In fact, people don't even now know even where Japan is. So it's a world that is going into long-term decline. Now, it is true that the U.S. is going into that decline slower than other countries. I would describe us here in the U.S. as being the tallest midget in the group. And that's sort of where I am about the world. And we need a rocking change in the thing, a change in direction in all of these five kingdoms. And we need it soon to get reestablished growth and prosperity in the world economy. Much the way Reagan did it, much the way Kennedy did it. Kennedy was very short-lived, but Reagan started it. It was Thatcher followed on, the rest of the world followed on. And we have been in this slow period. And I'm very concerned about the long-term health of the world economy and the U.S. economy. I hope that you don't mind me going off the rails on this with you. And
as far as I'm concerned, my friend, you were right on the rails. You were taking the train exactly.
Okay, well, that's great, because I want to lay it down flat rather than answer bits and pieces, because they all fit into a grand scheme, a grand design. And not one of them is by itself the key. They're all together the policies we need to get prosperity.
All right. Well, the purpose of these videos is to help the viewers better understand what's going on. So the better that I just let you paint the whole picture of the system, the better.
I just did, and forgive me.
No. It's great. Now, the second part of my question we didn't really address, but we are going to get to it anyway. So don't worry. And that's your thoughts on the financial markets. But let's stay here on the macroeconomic side of things for a bit. Of your five pillars of the kingdom, we're out of range dramatically, I would say, listening to you on all of these. I think for the first four, I can say that we're out of range with too much versus too little. Too much taxation, too complicated, too much fiscal spending, too much monetary policy intervention, too much regulation. Would you put international trade on at too little or too much?
Too much intervention, too little free trade. You know, frankly, trade is an enormous driver of prosperity. For the first 150 years of U.S. history, it was trade and trade alone that created us the greatest nation on earth, free trade with the world. And when you look at it today, you hear people talking about sanctions, embargoes, blah, 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 and all this sort of protectionist type of stuff, mercantilist stuff. I mean, you know, when you look at trade, you know, it's much more than just trade. I mean, Bob Mundell, my mentor and my colleague for years, in his Nobel laureate speech, said that it was the Smoot-Hawley tariff of protectionism that led to the Great Depression. And it was the Great Depression that led to World War II and the massive loss of life and prosperity and fortune. You know, it's true. We should be trading extensively with Russia, with Iran, with China, and with North Korea. Now, I'm not suggesting we trade with them in nuclear weapons, okay? I'm not. But trying to boycott, putting on sanctions is the exact wrong direction to go. We need to do business with them. When you sit down and do business with people, you tend to like your customers, you like your suppliers, you make money with them, and you talk, you converse, you understand, you send birthday cards, you do all this, and you say, you know, what you guys are doing with the Uyghurs in China is probably not a good idea. Well, what about you over there in the United States? And you solve problems through discussion, through negotiation, through peace, not through wars, threatenings. We have had sanctions against Cuba now since 1959. What's that? Is that 65 years? Can you see how well they've worked?
Yeah.
I mean, when you look at it, do you think the Cubans love America? Oh, my God, thank you, America, for showing us the democratic economic capitalism. How wonderful. We understand it. We're so grateful for you to show us. No, they hate us to the core. And the truth is here, we need to have interaction with these countries. And again, not in weaponry. Trade helps everyone. And it really helps countries working together to prohibit what would be like the Ukrainian war or the Gaza situation. All of these things are all are a result of the mismatch of people's interaction with each other. And we cannot afford another global war. We cannot afford any of these types of impediments to free trade and growth. It not only makes us richer, it makes us more friendly, and it makes us more of colleagues rather than combatants. I hope you understand, I'm a trade economist, and to me, free trade is the central piece of prosperity and peace in the world.
Okay, and that's exactly where I was going to go, where you're seeing economics as actually a tool and vehicle for peace when done right.
It sure is. It really is. I mean, look at what happened under Reagan. I mean, look at what happened under Trump. I mean, look at all those things. We didn't have it. We get into Biden. And then all of a sudden you find we have Gaza, we have the Houthis, we have the Ukrainian war. Do you think any of those would have happened with Trump as president, with the tax cuts and growth and the pro-growth agenda? No, I don't think so.
Dr. Laffer, for folks that haven't seen my previous interviews with you, you have been involved in many different presidential administrations, both sides of the aisle.
Yes,
so when you sling criticism, it's not from a partisan standpoint. It's from a gentleman who's very familiar with the workings of Capitol Hill, the various different administrations, and you're looking at it largely through an economic lens about
what you think
works and what doesn't.
Thank you. I've been going to the Oval Office now for 53 years. I was in the Nixon White House with George Shultz. I was his right-hand person from 1970 on in that position there. So I've been going to the Oval Office. I've been involved in this stuff forever. And, you know, it's really hard to get politicians to see it because, you know, Clinton can stand up on a podium and give a 20-minute rousing speech why we need to be tough with Russia and sanction them. You know, it's really disingenuous and it doesn't work towards the goals that we share and we want. And by the way, it's not just Hillary, it's Republicans too. It's a bipartisan ignorance that transcends logic.
Okay. Well, at the risk of really depressing the audience, I'm compelled to ask this next question, which
Good.
Is you have said, look, the pillars are crumbling. If we don't want to just slouch off into our senescence, you know, from here, we need dramatic reform. We need to reverse these trends.
Yes.
What is the likelihood you see that happening anytime soon?
I felt this same way in the late 1970s. It was Jimmy Carter following on the heels of Johnson, Nixon, Ford, and Carter. I'm a Kennedy Democrat from the 60s. And then you got Johnson, Nixon, Ford, and Carter, what I refer to as the Four Stooges. The largest assemblage of bipartisan ignorance ever put on planet Earth. And I didn't see any way of this thing being undone. And then all of a sudden the clouds parted, the sun shone forth on the earth, the fields, they turned green, the animals multiplied, the trees blossomed and bore fruit, the orphans got adoptive homes, the enemies, and we had Ronald Reagan, we had bipartisan growth for an incredibly long period of time. And you know, this is something that I expect it will happen in this event too. We need a political shift, and I think that political shift will come. And once it hits the U.S., it will spread to the rest of the world like wildfire. And I am very optimistic about the next two decades on this planet. That's me talking. Now, maybe it's just a hallucinogenic happiness, but I really do think that we are on the cusp of recognizing these problems and switching and going to a low rate, broad based flat tax, spending restraint, sound money, minimal regulations and free trade, and then get the government the hell out of the way and watch that prosperity hit all these people who so rightfully deserve it.
So I will share that every step along the way. Let me tell you what my pessimistic brain thinks here.
Okay.
And I'm not trying to rain on your optimism. I'm actually
hoping you can pull me more
into yours. But I look at the current cast of characters, which you know much better than I. I look at the division, and I look at the cronyism. I look at the captured special, how DC seems to be very captured by special interests. And I don't necessarily disagree with you that I think we will eventually adopt these reforms. I fear it's going to be kind of at a gun to the head basis, where it's like, because we have no other option, because the system that we have is just breaking so painfully that we need to finally say, we're going to have to stop doing business as usual and try something else. Do you think we'll get there proactively? Like, oh, hey, this is a better way to do it. Let's do it. Or do you think we're going to get forced there to do it?
Well, what would you consider, Reagan, proactive or forced to it? Never mind. I got my answer just by your hesitation.
Go for it. I mean, I got in many ways forced to it because inflation was crazy when he came
in. Yeah, but that's what it is now. I mean, that's what they saw. All these other things are the participation rates really low now. Real GDP growth has been bad for 25 years. It's been just all, and we're not the worst in the world. I mean, God, but let me just tell you that just to pique your interest, the highest marginal income tax rate in the U.S. in 1944 was?
94%. It's pretty ridiculous, 94%. Right? 94%, yeah.
94%. Today it is 37%.
37, okay, right.
In 1960, when John F. Kennedy took office, the corporate rate was 52%.
Was that high? Wow. Okay.
Today it's 21%. Mm-hmm. In 1976, there was only one state in the United States that did not have a statewide death tax, gift and estate tax, and that was Nevada. Today, 38 states are without a gift and death tax. In 1957, there were only two states that were right to work. That was Arkansas and Florida. And by the way, in 57, Florida was Arkansas, just for the record. Today, I think it's a little bit over half have right to work. I could go on and on. If you look at the clean air that's now in LA, when I was in LA, every breath of air was 10 calories.
Yep.
You know, people said they didn't trust air, they couldn't see, and you know, all this stuff. Today, air in LA is pretty clean. I mean, we've made huge progress. Animal species are coming back. I mean, the seas, the ocean. I mean, we have a lot to be grateful for. We had the retail price maintenance of Hubert Humphrey. It was illegal to discount product prices in stores. Illegal. You couldn't sell anything on Sundays. We had the blue law. All those are going and all that. And if you look at all of this stuff, it's just very exciting. Now, it is true we get pushback. That's true. We lose weight, then we make an advance again. But the history since 1944, and let's say that's 80 years, has been of progress, of major economic progress, of freer trade, of lower taxes, of more spending restraint, of all of that. That is, I believe, the underlying trend. And I believe when this election comes through and what happens in the next couple of years, you'll see that advancement come very quickly.
Okay. Let me ask a question that some might interpret as partisan, and it's not. I'm going to repeat
okay.
the qualifier that we just said. And I'm saying it for the audience, because adults should be able to have this type of discussion without, you know, being accused of being a partisan hack. How would you rate the current administration from an economic standpoint? And then how would you rate the previous administration? Because we're going to get one of those two
Yeah,
post November.
this administration, I think, is wrong on all five policies. I mean, they want to raise taxes, and they have raised them substantially. The overspending there is incredible. Monetary policy, what is it, 20% inflation? If you looked at the balance sheet of the Fed, I mean, it's just gone way up. It's gone from 800 billion to, I think it was up to 9 trillion. Now it's
Over
down
nine
about
trillion,
seven and a
yep.
half. It's now down to maybe 7.5, 7.6 trillion, way out of control. If you look at regulations, we won't allow anyone drill anywhere, do anything, anytime, anywhere. This administration's wrong on that one. And lastly, they're putting out sanctions, they're boycotting, they're doing all this, expropriating property of other countries. This administration is one of the worst I've seen in my life. And, I thought Biden was the best choice for the Democrats, and I think he's done a bad job. And I'm just saying it the way I see it. And when I look at Trump, and I'm again talking only economics, the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act was spectacular. If you look at his energy, to policy, we were self-sufficient on energy on that. If you look at his transparency executive order, which is, I just think Trump in his first term was the single best president on economics. Now, I'm just talking economics. I can understand people's views of him personally. But on economics, he's the single best president I think we've had in my lifetime and maybe for the last 150 years. It's just, I mean, he even outdid my hero, Ronald Reagan, and my other hero, John F. Kennedy. It's amazing what Trump did, I think, on economics.
Wow. Okay. All right.
And I
So,
don't mean to be partisan in that. That's just my view. And,
you've
I
got your
was a
economic
Kennedy
goggles on. I
Democrat.
get it.
And, there I go.
No. I very much appreciate the honesty and the transparency. And I've got some other questions about the
Sure.
election and how it's going to sort of impact things between now and then. But let me save that for the end.
Sure.
Let me ask you this. Actually, really quickly before I do, just because it's tax related and I know taxes are super near and dear to your heart. There was just, it seemed, a trial balloon last week floated about increasing the capital gains tax rate up to 44%. I'm guessing you're not a fan of that, but
No.
do you think that stands a chance, assuming, say, that the administration is reelected, or do you think that's just,
Well,
a bargaining chip for something else?
it would take more than just reelected, but it shows a sentiment, it shows a direction. First place that the capital gains, let's go back to the first day of the Biden administration. Capital gains are measured in nominal terms. So if you had a $100 investment when Biden took office, all right, and that investment now is $120, all you've done is offset inflation. But you would be liable for taxation on that $20 because they would consider that a capital gain.
Right. So
So
even though it went up, your real return on the investment would be negative.
it would be clearly that, yeah. And by the way, that's called bracket creep when it's on the income tax system. But in capital, if you have depreciation for equipment, let's say you're a company and you have a machine that you depreciate in order to be able to replace it, it wears out. If you do that, depreciation schedules are based upon what you paid for the machine, not what its replacement cost is. Its replacement cost is based on inflation. And so, therefore, again, you'd be way under depreciating or way underestimating the costs associated with producing a product, and therefore overstating taxable profits. And that too, there. And I could go through price controls and other types of things as well. So the inflation has had a very major impact on capital gains. It's had it through corporation depreciation and through nominal capital gains, as I showed you there. And so therefore, we've had a very sharp increase in the capital gains tax under Biden. That has been the case. And now he wants to make it even bigger. And that just is plain counterproductive. It makes no sense whatsoever. And you're not going to get any money for it, by the way. They're going to lose money with it.
It's just interesting, and I hope to have time before we're done to really trundle into the wealth divide in this country and how
I'd
it continues.
love to talk that. My book, Taxes Have Consequences, addresses that issue precisely.
Okay. Viewers know that's super near and dear to my heart, so we'll
Well,
make
let's
sure
do
we get some
that right
time for
away
that.
then.
Okay. Well, one of the reasons why I think I just can't imagine like this capital gains tax increase would actually go through at this level is
Can you
because
imagine a president proposing it?
Yeah, well, I mean, his backers, I just think, are a lot of these very rich people who make their money.
Why would he propose it?
Pardon me?
Why would he propose it?
I'm assuming to, curry favor among progressive voters of, hey,
His
we, you know, I know
financial
you're bad.
backers, I don't think so.
Yeah.
And he's talking hostile stuff about the rich all the time. The rich
And
don't
I'm
pay
just
their
curious,
fair share.
you know DC better than I. What is your assessment of the reason behind that?
I think it's a loser, and I think he's making a mistake. I mean,
Okay.
in my book, taxes have consequences. Maybe I should just talk about this with you for a second, because it hits right to the topics you're talking about here.
Okay, great. Let me wind you up and let you go. Let me
Sure,
just put
sorry.
one more
Sure,
topic in there
please.
so you can address it in your
Yep.
answer, which is I have heard sort of rumblings, not an official proposal that I've seen, but rumblings of not only increasing the capital gains, but having a tax on unrealized gains. And I'm just
That's right.
wondering if you think that that is actually a credible possibility.
These are all part and parcel of a full broad project there. He wants to tax unrealized capital gains. He wants to raise income tax rates. He wants to do a wealth tax. He also wants to increase the capital gains tax. There, I could go on and on and on. All of it is in a misguided sense of A, what's political, and B, what the economic consequences are. And this is exactly what I addressed the book. And let me come back to you again to try to slither it in. I did this book called Taxes Have Consequences with two co-authors, Dr. Brian Dmytryk and Dr. Gene Sinkfield. It is a complete history of the US income tax from the last 2 months of 1913, when the income tax was put into place, to the present day. We have every single tax return. This is not hypothesizing. The three worst words in French, German, and English are nach meiner Meinung, à mon avis, and in my opinion. I'm looking at the facts here, what the data are, not how you feel. I could give a damn how anyone feels. This is not about you. It's about what the facts are and what actually happens. And looking at this, I've looked at it from the perspective of these policies that you've described, the taxing the rich, the capital gains, and all of that. I looked at it in terms of the top 1% and the bottom 99%. The Sancheva, Zuckman, Saez, Piketty, all those, Bernie Sanders, AOC, Elizabeth Warren, all of that perspective of the modern, those people. I've looked at it from their perspective. And let me just give you a summary of the issues you're talking about from these data. And these are data. This is not what I wished happened. I could imagine the other side happening. I could imagine this side happening. But every single time we have raised tax rates on the top 1% of income earners, three things have happened. Number one, the economy has underperformed. Number two, real tax revenues from the top 1% of income earners have gone down. Down, not up.
Is that because
And
they just learn how to avoid it? They
of course,
power
yes,
to ignore.
duh. They can hire lawyers, accountants, deferred income specialists, favor grabbers, lobbyists. When you see a bunch of people hanging around with Biden, don't think they're poor people trying to explain to him what it's like being poor. They're sitting there, people working about exemptions, deductions, exclusions. And these people have the means to hire those lawyers and accountants and deferred income specialists, favor grabbing. They have the ways they can change the timing of their income. They can change the volume of their income. They can change the location of their income. They can change the composition of their income. And they do. And the history of this is what we document in the second chapter, which is all the major tax sheltering deductions that they've done through the political process. But number one, raising tax rates on the rich causes underperformance. Number two, it causes a reduction in tax revenues from the rich. And number three, it causes the poor to be hammered. The poor suffered enormously during World War II. They suffered enormously during the Great Depression. They suffered enormously in the period 1913 to 1918. They really did. They did not fare well under Johnson, Nixon, Ford, and Carter. They really didn't. They did badly. Now, when we've cut tax rates on the rich, every single time the economy has outperformed, tax revenues from the rich have gone up, and the poor have done relatively well. They've gotten full employment, they've gotten jobs, boop, boop, and their incomes have risen. For example, Trump, median incomes rose by $6,000. Under Biden, they've fallen by $2,000. You know, I could go on and on, but this is what's happening. And these are the facts. And this isn't what I wish would happen or I wish didn't happen. It's what happens. And it happens every time in Britain as well and in other countries.
So let me speak to maybe some emotions the viewers might be feeling right now. So because of a lot of the policies that are a lot of the what we think are some of the poor policies that are being pursued, it seems that the outcome of all these policies pretty much ends up helping the top 1%, right? So you intervene with fiscal, you know, crazy fiscal spending, you know, whatever the monetary, you know, fiscal monetary response to COVID or whatnot. You know, they tend to always goose asset prices. Well, who does that help? Well, that helps the people with asset prices. They also come at an inflationary cost. Well, who does inflation hurt more? Well, people who can't escape it, you know, the bottom 80%+, right? So I think emotionally, some people might hear what you're saying as, okay, so to get out of this, we have to like help the rich even more by lowering their taxes?
Ouch.
Yeah. So how do you square that circle for them?
Let me say it a little bit differently. It is very true that when you raise tax rates on the rich, income inequality declines. It is very true when you cut tax rates on the rich, income inequality increases. But it doesn't increase by the expense of one to the benefit of the other, or the benefit of the one to the expense of the other. When you raise tax rates on the rich, all right, when you do that, reported incomes from the rich drop by more than do reported incomes on the poor. But they both drop dramatically. When you have tax cuts, reported incomes on the rich go way up, and they go up by more than reported incomes on the poor. But the poor get a lot better off, but the rich get a lot better off because they stop sheltering their income. That's exactly what happens. If you want the poor to do well, you would be well advised not to hurt the rich. This is a system whereby these two groups are like boats on a sea, and a rising tide raises both boats. Now, it may raise the wealthy boat faster. That may be true. But if you have a low tide, if the tide sinks, let me tell you, the big boat sinks faster, but all boats sink. The only way I know of creating prosperity, and the only way I know of it, is through economic growth, helping all people, and then getting the mixing of the groups so that young people become rich, so that we provide jobs in our inner cities rather than welfare. And so we get a method out of the process. Now, I wrote Enterprise Zones back in 1974, which would make the inner cities tax-free zones, so that we can bring prosperity to those people in the inner cities that have been bypassed by the American prosperity experience. And that's what I would do, is make them tax-free zones. But you see where I'm coming from.
I do. And actually, if there's more, I'd love to let you run even further, which...
Well, I've got one other one that is more.
Okay, well, let me just ask this question. Okay. You can do what you want, which is, everybody wakes up tomorrow and says, you know what? Dr. Laffer should be emperor. We elect you emperor. What reforms that you haven't already mentioned would you put in place?
I would put in the one that I put in for Jerry Brown when I was his economist when he ran for president. Get rid of all federal taxes except for two. One would be an unadjusted gross income tax, flat tax, and the other one would be a net sales tax, or you might call it a value added tax. Yeah. If you replaced all federal taxes with these two flat rate taxes from the first dollar to the last dollar with no deductions, no exemptions, et cetera, you could do it with a tax rate of 11.8%. I rounded it up for Jerry to 12%. He rounded it up to 13%. In the Democratic primary in 1992, we went from eighth in the race to second in the race because of this flat tax. That's what I do on taxes there. On enterprise zones, on helping the poor, I'd make those inner cities tax-free zones to allow people to invest and work and get rid of the payroll tax, get rid of the minimum wage, get all of that stuff in the enterprise zone so these people can be brought into the mainstream of economics. I'd have medical transparency, where hospitals and all medical providers would be required to publish their transactions prices and the quality of the procedures ahead of time so we can all know what we're buying and how much it costs and what the qualities are. These are the ones I do. I do that there. But all of it relies on the spending one I want to do most of all with you, because that's not, I can't have a cliche on that one like I did with the Jerry Brown, because I did do it for Jerry. And we really came close. And by the way, I don't know if you realize he was a Democrat.
I do.
A liberal Democrat. He's one of the best governors ever California ever had. And he was phenomenal on the hip, on the trail. I mean, he would have been a wonderful president. But it's called the transfer theorem. And this theorem is really important for you to understand and every one of your viewers to understand, because it's economics. It's math. It's not liberal or conservative, left wing or right wing, Republican or Democrat or whatever the heck you are. A transfer occurs when the government takes from one group and gives to another group. Mm-hmm. That's called a transfer. It can be from tall people to short people, which I love. It can be from young people to old people, which I love again. Or normally speaking, we talk about we take from those who have a little bit more and we give to those who have a little bit less. Mm-hmm. That's the normal way we think of it. You with me?
I'm with you.
And that's the way. Now, we do that to make the rich a little bit less well off, but you know they can afford it, and to make the poor a little bit better off, and they desperately need it. This is the logic underlying the transfer theorem. But let me go through it in economics. By taking from those who make a little bit more, we reduce their incentives to produce.
Right.
And they will produce a little bit less. Clear?
Very clear. This is sort of where I was looking forward to digging in with you. So I get it. Keep going.
By giving to those who have a little bit less, we provide them with an alternative source of income other than working. And they too will produce a little bit less. Clear? The theorem here is really simple. Whenever you redistribute income, it's math. Whenever you redistribute income, you always reduce total income, period. There is no stimulus to stimulus spending. That is acres and acres of soap suds and horse poop. There is no stimulus in stimulus spending, period. And that's it. Now, when you look at this, you can see it intuitively. And let me just do it intuitively for you here. If you tax people who work and you pay people who don't work, would it surprise you if I told you there are going to be less people working?
Not at all.
That's the theorem. And that's a theorem that's math. I don't care whether you're a Harvard professor or anywhere, a commie, capitalist, whatever you can be. That's the theorem. Now, the lemma from this theorem is delicious. I'm not going to prove it to you verbally, but the lemma from this theorem is delicious, which is, and it should be intuitive, the more you redistribute, the greater will be the loss in total income.
Okay.
That should be pretty obvious.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the limit function of this theorem is exquisite. It's got this pecan flavor. It's got this clears your, I mean, my grandmother used to use ammonium salts, and it's just wonderful there. The limit function of this theorem is if you were able to redistribute all income so that everyone came out exactly the same, there will be no income whatsoever. Now, let me prove this to you verbally on this if I can. All right. In order to redistribute income such that everyone comes out the same, what you'd have to do is you'd have to tax everyone who makes above the average income 100% of the excess. And you'd have to subsidize everyone below the average income up to the average income.
Mm-hmm.
Only in this way can you assure that everyone comes out exactly the same. Now, if we actually did that, if we actually taxed everyone above the average income 100% of the excess, and we actually subsidize everyone below the average income up to the average income, I will stipulate today, counselor, we'll all be equal, and we'll be equal at zero. And that's what these guys are doing. That's what we've been doing with the stimulus spending. You've got bad tax policy. You've got bad spending policy. You've had bad monetary policy creating fiscal problems as well as monetary problems. You've had horrible regulation policies, and trade policies have been abysmal. Bingo.
So all that makes total sense to me, and there's so much more I want to say to you about it, but I know that we're limited by a tight deadline.
We can do another one later if you'd ever like to.
I would absolutely love to.
We should do something on property taxes. That's where I've been working lately. It is incredible, the property tax problem. That could be a whole show.
All right, folks, if you're interested in Dr. Laffer coming back when his schedule allows, let me know in the comment section below if Dr. Laffer's response is like, I think it
I would love to. I would
we'll have
love
you
to.
Back on soon. My question is okay, so wonderful platform. Makes tons of sense to me. Wish we were going through that punch list of things that you just mentioned. We are not today. We are in fact digging the hole even deeper, right?
Yes.
I know that you've got this optimism that you mentioned. I'm going to guess it's not like we're going to wake up one morning and it's going to be sunshine and roses, that it's going to be a
it won't take long.
Slug.
Once the policies are put in, boy, it doesn't take long. And when it goes, it goes like a jackrabbit. Do you know what the growth rate? Let me just, excuse me for interrupting you here.
Sure.
January, you know, our tax cuts under Reagan took effect on January 1st, 1983. That's when the phase-in ended. Okay, bam, they were there. From January 1st, 1983 to June 30th, 1984. That's a year and a half, right?
Yeah.
That's
not very long.
18 months. That's six quarters. Total real GDP growth in that 18 months was how much?
Oh gosh, I can't remember.
12%. We grew at a compound annual rate of 8% per annum.
Wow.
In 18 months. It just changed course, and we people respond to incentives. I mean, they really responded. Drop a $100 bill in a crowd and see how long it takes to be picked up.
No, I'm there with you. I'm a huge fan of the Charlie Munger, you know, it's all about incentives and getting the incentives
That's
right.
That's it.
Yep.
Poor Charlie.
In a math might, pardon me?
He passed.
He did pass. That's a huge loss last year.
Well, he was 95, though, I think.
Yeah. Was it last year or early this year? But anyways, it was relatively recently. A huge loss for all of us. But that lesson, I just hope more and more people take. And of course, you're a math-minded professional who has seen math applied to policy and see that incentives really,
really
do work.
It works.
Okay. So in terms of changing the incentives, at the end of the day, you know, this is what I say is... I believe, as you, that you need to have three parties working well together. The voting populace, and their job is essentially is to set the values and what the incentives should be, right?
Yes.
And then you have government, which is there to basically set the borders of the playing field in the rules and serve as referee, more or less. Right. Maybe they build the playing field. They're providing whatever infrastructure that you need to play the game. But then you let the free market within the borders you've defined run everything.
Yeah.
Right. So the big question is, what's it going to take for the incentives to change? I guess that means it's going to be we as the populace have to start electing and demanding people who want to, you know, who would support and push for the type of incentives we want to get into office. From what you've told me, I'm guessing you're thinking you're going to have a very different outlook on the timeline depending upon how the results go in November. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, that's fair. But it's been like that forever. It's nothing new. And if we don't do it this time, we'll do it next time.
Okay. And again, to my earlier point, is that because maybe the gun will get a little bit closer to our head where we're
perhaps
just going to feel...
I don't like that analogy very much, but it's probably true what you're saying. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, we were in bad shape under Jimmy Carter and then boom, we got Reagan.
Okay. So I love this conversation because what you're saying to me is, hey, Adam, I feel your pain and the pain of your viewers in terms of all the concerns you have about the current state of affairs. But I hear you have this optimism that says, but hey, guys, the game isn't lost. In fact, we can kind of, you know, reverse our fortune pretty quickly and start getting a winning game going here. We just have to, as a nation, you know, collectively decide that we've got these priorities now and
yeah,
these incentives
right.
we're going to pursue.
And let me give you an example of it. I mean, we had a horrible time. I was in the Nixon White House, as I mentioned to you. And after that, with Watergate and all that, Nixon was elected, I think it was in 1972. I think he won 49 out of 50 states. It's one of the biggest landslides ever. By 74, he was being impeached at Watergate, so it was a thing. This huge reversal of fortunes, everyone coming at daggers. It was the most partisanly toxic world I've ever seen, much like today. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was really toxic. Now, that was in 74, 75, 76. Jimmy Carter won, beat Gerry Ford. Then we had the Carter era, and then we got Reagan. who switched the paradigm 100% to the way I'm describing, as you know, my role with Reagan. And then we got there. Let me tell you what happened during that paradigm shift. And with the same people, by the way. The 86 Tax Act. We cut the highest marginal income tax rate from 50% to 28%. That a good enough tax cut on the fat cat Richies?
Yeah.
Pretty good. We raised the lowest rate. We're going to get those poor people. We raised the lowest rate from 12.5% to 15%. We went from 11 tax brackets to 2 tax brackets. And just to make sure you don't have any misunderstanding on this, we cut the corporate rate from 46% to 34%. You with me?
I'm with you.
That's what we did. Can you imagine that bill today?
Not at all.
One person who voted for it. No one.
Yeah.
Everyone would run away screaming and hollering. We passed that bill in the Senate. We passed it in the House too by a huge amount. But let me just tell you, do you know what the vote was in the Senate in that bill?
I would think super close, but you tell me.
97-3.
Really?
Yeah, really. Paul Simon from Illinois, that little guy with a bow tie.
Yeah, I remember him, yeah.
Yeah, and then the guy Levin from Michigan voted against it. And Merkley, I think, from Montana voted against it. Everyone else voted. Teddy Kennedy voted for it. Tall and Pink Bill Bradley voted for it. Al Gore voted for it. He told me it was the best bill he'd ever voted for in his life. So and I also that guy from the senator from Delaware. What was his name, Bob?
Joe Biden,
he voted for it. You know, all I'm telling you is that success is just a minute away once we change.
Okay.
And it comes in a flood in this massive move. Everyone is trying to out Reagan. And it was delicious. It was wonderful. It was delightful. It was they couldn't dreamed better.
All right. You're making me feel great. You're really injecting me with some mainline optimism.
It's true.
Wonderful. And I very much appreciate it. Is that partially because, and I know you hate the analogy, but was the gun at the temple at that point because inflation was so high? So it's sort of like with Volcker, you know, we went through the 70s not killing inflation because the Fed didn't have the mandate to do whatever it took until
Volcker. They didn't know how to do it. Paul Volcker knew how to do it. You know, Jay Powell looks to his staff for advice. Paul Volcker told his staff what he was doing. You know, Paul Volcker was a professional. These guys aren't. But they can be. We can recreate them. Don't worry. You know,
okay.
Paul Volcker was there and everything else. I mean, we have George Shultz in taxes. I mean, with Reagan, it was wonderful. We had Don Regan. Now, these people weren't telling Reagan. Reagan set the tone. He set the flavor. He set the world stage. And I could take you through tons of stories because I've been involved with Reagan from the beginning of time. My godfather was his best friend. So I've had a special privilege relationship with him where it's much better to get these types of jobs through privilege than actually earning it. But Reagan set all the tones and then got all the technical people in there to do it correctly. And we got peace in our era, prosperity in our era, all because Reagan set the tone and got the guys like Shultz and Don Regan and Paul Volcker and these others to do it. And it just went. We'll do it again.
All right. We're going to end on optimism. It's a great place to end. Very quickly, Dr. Laffer, I know you got to hop, but for folks that have really enjoyed this conversation, would like more Art Laffer, where can they go?
I don't know. I have a website down there, the Laffer Center. It's not a very, you know, we're not very active on it, but you can find it and you can contact me. I'm in an office in Nashville, Tennessee, and a little office, and we do all sorts of economic research and working with states and countries. I just was over in Britain for a week with the parties there doing the policies there. I'm going to Seoul, South Korea shortly. I'm going to El Salvador with Bukele. I'm going to Brazil probably in the next couple of months. I've got that scheduled. And I might even be going to Kazakhstan and probably to Argentina with Malay. So you never know. Just get in touch with me anytime and I'll look at those emails and love to have you do it.
All right.
And I love being on your show. So if you want to do something on property tax, I'd love to.
Well, all right, folks, if you'd like to see Dr. Laffer come back on this program, please let him know by hitting the like button and then clicking on the red subscribe button below. as well as that little bell icon right next to it. And if he's correct, and we continue to descend into senescence here, at least in the foreseeable future, that's likely not going to be a fun time in the economy. It's likely going to have pretty big repercussions for the financial markets. So unless you're already a well-experienced DIY investor, highly recommend that most of the people watching this video should be navigating that under the guidance of a good professional financial advisor, but particularly one that takes into account all the issues that Dr. Laffer and I have talked about here, as well as the issues that the other guests who appear with me on this channel week after week discuss. If you've got a good one who's doing that for you and playing the role of a trusted, competent financial quarterback for you, great, you should stick with them. But if you don't have one, or you'd like a second opinion for one who does fit that mold, then consider scheduling a free consultation with one of the financial advisors endorsed by Thoughtful Money. To do that, just go to thoughtfulmoney.com. Dr. Laffer, it's been a true joy. Thanks so much for giving us this time, especially given how busy your schedule is.
I'm always here for you. This is easy to do.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank
Dr.
You,
Laffer, it's been a pleasure.
My pleasure. Thank you.